Welcome back to Real Science Radio. We are continuing our discussion with Dr. Clifford Denton, a former Royal Air Force pilot who received his PhD from Oxford, where he was involved in government-funded research. In the first part of our conversation, Dr. Denton shared the story behind how this research began, the many discussions he and his colleague Francis Pym had over the years as they wrestled with Einstein's theory of relativity and the famous Michelson-Morley experiment. They believed something about that standard explanation didn't make sense, which led them to start digging deeper into the assumptions underlying modern relativity. So in this next part of the discussion, Dr. Denton begins examining Einstein's two key assumptions that form the foundation of special relativity and why he believes those assumptions sent physics down the wrong path. We now continue where we left off at the end of part one. Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. Welcome back to Real Science Radio. We are continuing our discussion with Dr. Clifford Denton, a former Royal Air Force pilot who received his PhD from Oxford, where he was involved in government-funded research. In the first part of our conversation, Dr. Denton shared the story behind how this research began, the many discussions he and his colleague Francis Pym had over the years as they wrestled with Einstein's theory of relativity and the famous Michelson-Morley experiment. They believed something about that standard explanation didn't make sense, which led them to start digging deeper into the assumptions underlying modern relativity. So in this next part of the discussion, Dr. Denton begins examining Einstein's two key assumptions that form the foundation of special relativity and why he believes those assumptions sent physics down the wrong path. We now continue where we left off at the end of part one.
And what Einstein said was, well, we can't detect an ether, so we'll see if we can do it without needing to refer to it. So he was thinking, well, let's ignore it and see if we can get round it and open the way to further progress. So what he did then was to create two axioms, which we have on two slides, two axioms of the what became special relativity. First of all, number one is basically, let's do something that ignores the existence of the ether, whether it's there or not. Phrased as not only the phenomena of mechanics, but also of electrodynamics, have no properties that correspond to the concept of absolute rest. If we have an ether, we can therefore presume that there is a place of absolute rest in the universe, which is a kind of absolute measuring point for all other motion. But he says, let's not bother with that. Then that's the point. Everything becomes relative. There's nothing absolute about it anymore. He's saying, let's ignore the fact that about an ether and move forward from there. That's the number one. And number two on the next slide was that light always propagates in empty space with a definite velocity c that is independent of the state of motion of the emitting body. This is the bit that Francis and I wanted to challenge. And it is absolutely preposterous that whatever movement you have through the universe, however light is being shone, whether it's bouncing back from a reflector, whether you're moving towards it or it's moving away from you, whatever measurement you make, you'll always get the same answer. Nothing like that picture we saw of the sound, where when you move, you're moving away from the sound wave or towards it, so there's a speeding up or a slowing down related to your motion. According to Einstein, ignore it. You'll always get the value C. Why? Because Michelson-Morley couldn't detect the ether, and therefore, in their experiment, they couldn't find any difference in the speed of a light wave coming in one direction and the direction vertically to it. So Einstein says, well, never mind. Let's assume it then. Let's assume whatever happens, we will always get that value. That is a massive assumption. I don't think most people know that, how absolutely irrational it is. It's good that it seems, Dr. Moore, experimental, observational data now that shows that that's not true. But it's not logically true, it's not intellectually true, but somehow or other, based on these couple of axioms, comes special relativity and then general relativity, which refers to gravitation. Out of these simple hypotheses comes a massive error, if they are wrong. And we're talking about high speed, things that are going so fast that we don't experience them in ordinary life, but they're conjectures of what would happen at high speed. For example, if we were going at the speed of light, which is about 186,000 miles a second, towards something going towards us at 100,000 miles a second, we would expect the light to impinge on our spaceship at 286,000 miles a second. And yet, Einstein says, it will always hit you at 186,000 miles a second. Counterintuitive. But how do you tackle it? Well, one thing I would say is, I know that there are some observations of light coming through the universe to see if you can measure the passage of light in one direction. But mostly, experiments to find the velocity of light measure a two-way passage of this passage of light. From a source to a reflector and back again, that's two-way. So that on the outward passage and the backward passage from the source to the reflector, which you cannot actually measure, you that light is going so fast you can't keep up with it. So what you have to do is receive the beam back again and have a kind of averaging process of how long it took over a certain distance to get you that passage of light and then work out its speed. Einstein was really using a two-way passage of light perspective and making it work for a one-way passage of light, which again is not logical. What amazes me, if he did the calculations that came into my head when I was sitting with my friend Francis Pym on that day, if he'd done those calculations, surely he would never have gone down the road of special relativity. I can hardly believe that the simple equations that we look at were not discovered by anybody else. It is just amazing, which is part of that belief that this is a real spiritual deception, as well as a logical one. Anyway, the thing to do, therefore, is try to get a result that is compatible with more rational thinking. Into this comes two things. They have to enter into the investigation of light, which is different from the investigation of sound. When we have something moving very quickly through the universe, however the universe is made, I'd love to that the Epola worked. So let's imagine the Epola. We've got a body moving through this matrix, and surely that matrix has some effect on the moving body. There's an interaction between the particles of the moving body and the matrix, which is the Epola. We'll say that that's the model we'll look at. It's reasonable then that something happens in that interaction and that very high speed that we're talking about that will have a bearing on the physical movement. Now, this is where the passage of light differs from the passage of sound. Passage of sound is, in the simpler examples, although you could always change matters to complicate that, but in the simple example, we're looking at things we can see and we feel, we can gather some air and know what we're talking about. We can analyze it and find its chemical constituency. We can work on it, but it's very hard to work on this thing called the ether. We can't see it. We can't gather it in a bucket. We can't heat it up and see if it expands. We've got to have a model to try to explain what might be going on. But if it is there, it is likely to interact with the moving body. Now, when you come to the special theory of relativity, you come to two things. One is called time dilation, and the other is called length contraction. This is where we have to make sure we get our mind straight. In special relativity terms, these two things are a result of the equation of space and time, that with the changing equations of space and time, time changes and lengths shorten. And that is not what we're talking about in this case, though. They are to do with equations which were challenging. But as Dr. Moore has already said, that it seems that Newton said it from your quote, that it's not that time changes in motion, it is the measurement of time changes. So that if you have a clock moving through the ether will have a bearing on the vibrations in that clock. So the clock will change in its vibrations, whatever sort of clock it is, so that the time measurement will change.
This episode of Real Science Radio is brought to you by Door County Coffee. A few years ago, one of the friends I watched football with on Sunday turned me on to this coffee, and I have to admit, it may have been the best thing he ever contributed to the group. Now, if you love great coffee like I do, you've got to check them out. Some of my favorites are Chocolate Raspberry Truffle, which blends rich dark chocolate with fresh raspberry flavor, Highlander Grog, which I believe is their most popular coffee, and then Turtles in a Cup, which my wife and I just love, and we've already started this bag. It tastes like chocolate, caramel, and toasted pecans all in one mug. So if you want to upgrade your morning coffee or your afternoon coffee, or let's be honest, your evening coffee, head over to DoorCountyCoffee.com and grab a bag or two. Okay, Dr. Denton, I wanted to stop you right here because I want to make sure that people understand the whole thing about how time was redefined. Time itself, instead of the clocks being the issue, the clock slowing down, Einstein messed with time itself, something we think is just a passage of one moment to the next. He turned it into, if you will, something material, right? He basically is messing with time. And I know it was controversial at first, but for whatever reason, so many people have latched on to this part of how, you know, time itself can slow down or increase. And I wanted to make sure the audience is aware of what Einstein did here and what Sir Isaac Newton warned could happen in the future of messing with things like in math, messing with the time variable and saying that it's variable instead of the clock.
Exactly. It's so subtle that you can miss it. It sounds almost the same thing, but it's not. I am simplistic enough to think that when the Lord created the universe and he said that the sun and the stars and so on would define days and times and seasons, that's what he meant. And constantly over all of the years since then, up until the 1960s, time was measured by the passage of the earth around the sun. And the day is defined that way and divided up into hours and minutes on a simple version of a clock. But then came in the more modern clocks, which are based on crystals or other vibrations in a different medium. And if you move those through the ether, you are going to find that the crystal vibrations, for example, will change their frequency. So that will have an effect on what the clock says its time is. Time will seem to slow with motion, but in fact, it is just the measuring instrument that is changing.
The clock.
And I would say it is not simplistic to go back to what the Creator made and make our clocks conform to the absolutes of the motion around the sun. And there are many, many years of eminent scientists who have checked their time by an ordinary clock of that sort. It's not a foolishness to suggest that. But when you go into modern sorts of clocks, they are going to change their measurements with motion. So Einstein, did he create the idea of time dilation? Is that where we got the terminology from? So that it becomes a descriptor of time slowing, time changing. So if you're moving, your time is not the same as somebody else's time. It's just your clock is reading differently. He redefined time for that. And the other thing was length contraction, that when a body moves through the ether, it's going to have some interaction with the ether, which will likely make it squash up a bit. Now, that's all very general, but we've got to make this work in terms of different equations that will show Einstein was wrong in his suppositions, with all the consequences that follow about all that happens with light going through the universe. And there's multitudes of things going on because of this idea of special relativity. We've got to go back to the basics, but we still got to get it right. So we also, for a different reason, come and use a constant which is usually given the Greek letter gamma. So that it's a constant that is used in special relativity. Again, be careful we don't confuse the two, but we'll still use the same constant. If v is the speed we are traveling through the universe and c is the speed of light in that locality, the calculation of 1 minus square of v divided by the square of c gives you the square of a constant gamma. And gamma then being the square root of 1 minus v squared of c squared is a very familiar number in relativity theory. But we'll still use it. But we've got to justify its use relating to what we are saying isn't time dilation and length contraction in special relativity terms, but actual absolute change in time measurement and length measurement.
Dr. Dittman, is this gamma the Lorentz factor? Is that what the gamma is?
They come from the time of Lorentz, don't they, Pete?
Yeah, I think it was Lorentz who first kind of familiarized us with this these equations that we now call gamma.
Yeah. And Einstein took on board the Lorentz transformation equations, and they're a full part of special relativity. I remember sitting my friend Francis saying, well, what should we do about Lorentz? And his answer was, let's ditch it. You know, they have some use, but they've been misused and they confuse because they've linked space and time together rather than space and the measurement of time. So we have this constant, and then we have to tackle the idea of length contraction and time dilation. So this is where mine can be very fuzzy in this. Who is making the measurements is the big thing in this area of, certainly in relativity. Who is making the measurements? There's the observer who is moving at a different speed, and the observer who's moving at a faster or slower speed. One observing something in the other and counter. And then you end up with frames of reference that are so-called frames of reference, which become, as it were, worlds of their own, where time and space are measured according to relative motion. And then you can end up with confusion in your mind about who's measuring what and which equations refer to whose measurements. We need to make that simpler. But we have here, if two identical clocks record the same time event at a given instant, but one is moving at speed v with respect to the other, the observer who's stationary with the first clock will read the passage of time, t, on the stationary clock as gamma t on the moving clock. So one's measuring at t, and he notices the other one is measuring at gamma t. If he could do it, if he could observe somebody whizzing past at half the speed of light and look at their clock, it's just a hypothetical. But one observes something different of the other. And this is where we have to start uncomplicating it if we can. But that's what's called time dilation, that one observer sees something different on the other. And then length contraction, similarly, would be when there's a body moving whose length is L, we'll say, to a stationary observer. If it's then moving at speed V, the stationary observer will notice that it really looks like gamma L, a shortened version. So this is a one observer to another. That's how the gamma is applied in this idea of time dilation and length contraction. But what we need to do is make sure our mind is fixed on who's measuring what in this whole scenario. So let's have a look at how we can do that. If we look at the next slide, we'll see that we've defined a thing called an absolute frame of reference. What we have to do in all of this is have, in the end, a comprehensive picture of what is going on in the universe, what is going on in the material of the body that's traveling through the universe, as well as this single thing we're looking at today, the speed of light that is light being transmitted in a moving body. And what I wanted to say was that we had a go at time dilation and length contraction and published in a little book called Absolute Space and Time. We based it on a sort of quantum view of space, of material, and we based the clock on a simple light clock. But we realize that in order to make this viable in every area, we have to carry out a logical mathematical investigation of how time dilates and length contracts in whatever model we use. As far as I can understand, whatever we propose, is we call it a model. It is not necessarily the real thing. We cannot see with our eyes or microscopes the most minute things of the universe or materials. So we have to have what we call a model, like a parable, a picture, three-dimensional or more, of what we're looking. But we have to start somewhere. And we cannot go anywhere without starting somewhere. So you have to have some suppositions, and then on those suppositions, you make your way forward, seeing how you can explain everything that needs to be explained. So there are quantum views of matter. There are views of the ether. I like the apolar one. But whatever one we use, we have to do the maths within it to show the result that we're looking for. So all I can say is that Francis and I knew we should do this, and so we looked at our particular model, and within our particular model, which we published in this book, it's not in the paper that you're reading, in the book we did show that time dilation and length contraction can be accurately described in the way we have gamma T and gamma L. They're accurately described in the model we chose. So we have justification for saying that when a clock moves of a certain type within the universe, it will slow according to exactly the prediction that Einstein made in special relativity. And lengths will contract to exactly the prediction he made in special relativity. It's an overlap of results. It's for different reasons, though. We are working with absolutes. He turned everything relative to one another. So we cannot avoid the hard work. All I can say is, in our little book, we showed it could be done for a certain model of the universe and of materials. So that is an encouragement to go forward. With that encouragement, we can then go forward and do our calculations and show something that is really very simple and encouraging in itself. But when we are making measurements in the universe and we are referring to something which is distant, we do have a difficulty of synchronization of watches and so on, synchronization of time. So there's always going to be a difficulty in measuring the speed of light in one direction. But what we can do is set up an experiment to measure the speed of light in two directions, there and back, from a transmitter to receiver and back to the transmitter, and therefore average out, find the average speed of light to and from a reflector. And I don't think there's any other way of finding the speed of light other than that average. It's very annoying that we cannot chase a light beam and watch it on our clock and go a certain distance, and when we get there, we click it, and we got speed over time exactly. You can't do it with light. It's too fast. So in any experiment, you're going to have a there and back. And I think that is points to the error of Einstein, where he assumed that a there and back velocity of light indicated that the single direction velocity of light was always fixed. So let's have a look at the calculation. Here we have just a simple thing, rather like that sound diagram we had to start, where there's an emitter. In that case, it was sound going through a reflector and back. Now we're having a clock, an emitter and a clock at a point A, sending a light signal to a reflector at point B. We can measure the length between A and B, and we can measure the time it takes for the light beam to go from A to B and back, because we have a precise measurement when it starts and when it returns. Simple, you then find the speed of light in an absolute frame of reference, that is a stationary frame of reference in the ether, straightforward, distance over time, you've got the speed. You measure the distance A to B, you've got the clock, it's giving you its time, you do the calculation. That gives you the basic measurement C without any motion. Well, there's a supposition that we can actually find the rest position in the ether. You can't. Who's moving and who's not? We can't see it. Maybe we can make some progress with E-polar gradually through this sort of area. But this is supposed you can do it. Find the absolute stationary position, measure the speed of light. Now we're going to do a second experiment, rather like that sound illustration we had. We're going to have the body moving now through the ether, which we call an absolute frame of reference here. We're moving at speed V, and then we send a light signal in the direction that we are moving. Exactly similar to the sound, I keep saying it, because it helps to have that in mind, because it's no more difficult apart from this length and time change. So out the light goes and then the light returns. In Newtonian relative terms, we're not special relative, this is how you do calculations. As far as the observer at A goes, the speed that the light is going out at speed C minus V, that is the speed of light, take away his own speed. And it's coming back at C plus V, the speed of light plus his own speed, because the emitter is going towards the returning light. So now we've got light going out at speed C minus V and light returning at C plus V. Now we start doing some calculations. The time it takes for that light to go from A to B and back is the length over the speed outwards plus the length over the speed backwards. And you see that working through the calculations, you'll get to the time of the two-way journey, absolute time as measured in absolute terms, as what we've got there as 2L1C over C, and then brackets 1 minus V squared of C squared. And suddenly into our equation comes that familiar term that we defined earlier, that familiar special relativity one, but still applies to our calculations. When we put gamma in as a square root of 1 minus V squared of C squared, we notice that we've got a two-way light travel, and we get the time taken as twice the length of travel over gamma squared C. And then we have to note that within that, we will have a contracted length. So instead of the length that we have measured within the moving body, we are the observer moving, measuring it. To us, the length is gamma L. So we end up with substituting that into the equation. And we've got now, due to the contraction of time, that the time for the total two-way travel is twice the length over gamma C. Let's move on. We've got to bear in mind who's measuring it. The main thing is we want to be measuring it from the person, as it were, or the instruments that's actually moving. We have two possibilities. One is somebody's observing it from outside and they see what's happening. But we are the ones who are moving, and therefore we are measuring it on our instruments as we see them. So if we make the adjustment of time dilation and length contraction, first of all, the time dilation alters the time that we are measuring on the clock. Length contraction really shows that we shrink that length of the apparatus that's moving. If we're looking at it from the outside, we will see the shrunken length. But if we're measuring it from the inside, we will not see the shrunken length, because not only does the shrunken length take place, but also the rulers that measure that length. If the length of the light travel is, say, 20 meters, that 20 meters shrinks to gamma 20 meters, 20 meters times gamma. But the ruler that measured those 20 meters also shrinks by gamma. So he set that ruler alongside. It seems to be the same length.
Okay, Dr. Denton, okay. This is why Einstein was able to bamboozle everyone. This is so difficult to comprehend because everything is moving that for people without advanced mathematical and modeling skills, I can just tell you myself, I could easily be bamboozled on this. I'm just going to confess that right up front.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I put this to people before and they get in a fog. But let me try and simplify it. I'm trying to do it with the equations in front of us and speeding through them. But let me put it in simple terms.
Well, and this is the thing. You can't really get to the simple terms without going through and comprehending all of this. And the work that you've done is, it's just amazing. And you have to go there to get where I think you're going.
That's right.
And I think you're going somewhere. Let me just guess. I think you're going somewhere elegant.
Yes, it is. What we have to do is write it down accurately so that anybody who needs to check the calculations can go through them and say there's no error there. Because it is very easy to have good ideas in this area. But remember, we're countering how many years? More than 100 years of developing error from wrong assumptions. So we're not going to get it totally simple. We have to do a little bit of work. The work you have to do on these equations is actually not too tricky if you take 10 minutes instead of 2 to look at it. And I'm trying to do it in 2 just to show it's okay. But overall, it goes like this. The equations are there for you to check. The paper has been published peer review. The maths is okay. So what is happening is that you have a person moving at a large speed through the universe. He doesn't know where the absolute place of rest is, but he knows he's moving, or he may be. It doesn't matter that he doesn't need to measure it against the universe, in a sense, so he doesn't have to be the observer, but all he's doing is performing a calculation, an experiment, in his own spaceship. So he is moving at a certain speed through the universe, and he sends out a light ray to a reflector over a known distance in his spaceship. He has a clock that's accurate and measures the time of that light ray to go to the reflector and back. So he says, how do I find out the speed? I need to divide the distance by the time, and then I will have the speed. Straightforward. All he's got to do is do it with his apparatus in his moving machine. Distance over time equals speed. If he can measure the distance accurately, it's a two-way journey, and he gets the average speed to and from the reflector. What he has to do, though, well, he doesn't have to do any of this, but anybody observing him doing it knows that his length is correct, the length of his spaceship contracted, and his clock went slow. Anybody observing it knows that's happened.
Yep. And it's not.
And because it's happened, they know that the result he will always get will be the same value C. He will do the experiment. He will do it the measuring of his own instruments. And the value he will get is always C. It's an average two-way passage of light in the universe. It's as simple as taking the measurements if you've got accurate measurements. But what it required for him to get that answer is there had to be a genuine time contraction. His clock had to slow due to the motion on a measurable amount. And his length contraction was also happening. He can ignore it because all he does is the measurements. So anybody trying to explain it will have to take into account the reaction of that spaceship with the universe.
Are you saying that to understand what's going on would rely on an outside observer understanding what's going on?
No. It wouldn't. He would get the same value C, whatever he was doing. Whatever speed the spaceship was going, that two-way passage of light would always give him the constant value C. But if it were possible to have an observer, he would explain why it is all we see.
Ah.
Because he knows what right. he can't, the traveling man can't see it, but his lengths have contracted and his time has slowed. And that is the reason that he gets the same value C every time. But actually, to him, though he can't measure it, light is going out slower than it's coming back because he's moving relative to the light. In other words, light doesn't have to settle at the same speed. It's just measuring the speed in this sort of experiment, you'll always get the same result. And that explains, it's part of the explanation of Michelson-Morley, because they couldn't find any interference in, we'll look at this in a minute, but they couldn't find any interference with their light rays going out and returning. Therefore, they said, we haven't found the ether. But Einstein went on and said, the speed of light is constant, whatever happens. But I say, the measurement of the speed of light is always constant.
Okay, I think this is a good place to pause. What Dr. Denton has shown us is that when you carefully account for the physical effects of motion, things like the slowing of clocks and the contraction of lengths due to interaction with the medium of space, you can actually explain why experiments measuring light always produce the same value. In other words, the constant measured speed of light may not require time itself to stretch and shrink the way Einstein proposed. Instead, the measurements can be explained by the behavior of physical instruments moving through the structure of space. So stay tuned, because next week we'll finish this discussion and bring Dr. Pete Moore back in to weigh in on these ideas and if they fit with Professor Simhoni's EPOLA model.